Welcome everyone, and thank you for coming on such a cold, dark evening. We have Ashish Rai here, whom I think most of you know very well. He was an eminent journalist, and he has been the foreign correspondent since 1977 for BBC, CNN, ITN. He's also written for the Anand Bajar Group, the Times of India, the Tribune, the Hindustan Times, the Guardian, the Observer, the Times, Financial Times, and so on, and more. And he was, most importantly, CNN's founding editor in South Asia, and founding bureau chief, and editor-at-large. And he has been elected the president of Indian Journalists Association of Europe for several terms. In 1982, the Commonwealth Institute selected him among 10 eminent Indians in Britain. In 1995, he was conferred a National Press Award. He was made an academic visitor at St. Anthony's in 2021-22, and as an academic visitor, he did the research for this book. So we are especially delighted to have him here. It's a huge pleasure to have you, but particularly great for us because the book was produced here. I'm also delighted to welcome Dr. Kevin Knowles. We're very grateful to you, Kevin, for coming to comment and act as the discussant of the book. Kevin did his DPhil here on the topic of the INA, and the book is now with OUP to be out anytime soon. And I think Kevin and Ashish both have something in common, which is they had a life before writing books. So as far as I know, you worked in the computing sector, startups and such?
Indeed, in the city, etc.
In the city,
so very
yes.
Different.
So over to you. So we will have your presentation and then give you your comments.
Thank you very much. Professors, ladies and gentlemen of letters and friends, thank you for sparing the time to be here this evening. I realize that the traffic is particularly bad in Oxford this evening, and so I'm very happy that you've made it. In 2021, after half a century of uninterrupted journalism, I felt a little jaded. I needed to refresh myself, get away from journalism. Professor Rick Trainer, historian and then rector at Exeter College, encouraged me to expand on a passing reference I had made in a previous book about trials of soldiers of the rebel Indian National Army, or the INA, by the British authorities in the winter of 1945-46, hastening British withdrawal from India. So I arrived at Professor Faisal Devji's door in the middle of COVID. He was agreeably of the view that the INA element in the Indian freedom movement deserved enlargement. I was fortunately elected as an academic visitor at this college, as Nandini has mentioned, and permitted to work on the project. There's virtual unanimity among historians of consequence that the Indian National Congress's monumental struggle from 1885 to 1947 was largely instrumental in securing Indian independence. In other words, its mass non-violent, non-cooperation and civil disobedience, devised and spearheaded by Mohandas Gandhi, better known as the Mahatma, or Great Soul, is deemed to have been more successful than any other movement to ensure Britain's exit from India. That is not to say there weren't other efforts to pursue the same objective. Among these, arguably the most significant was the INA campaign. This audaciously attempted to liberate India by engaging the British Indian Army on India's northeastern front. The INA was defeated, but the trial of its men at Delhi's symbolic seat of power, the Red Fort, so incensed Indians that a continuation much longer of British hegemony over India became almost impossible. Subhash Bose, a former president of the Congress who spearheaded the INA, derived ideas and drew inspiration from previous instances of use of force by Indian nationalists. In the first chapter of my book, I illustrate such instances, notably the 1857 mutiny, but also revolutionary activities within India and the transnational Gadar movement in the 20th century. I do so for the sake of better understanding the INA, the trials, and the related Indian sentiments that impacted on Britain. From examples of use of force evolved Bose's concept of a military campaign from outside India at a time when the Gandhian struggle inside the country had come to a standstill. This was so because of a ban on the Congress by the British and widespread incarceration of its leaders and workers as retaliation to Gandhi's 1942 Quit India movement. Educated at Cambridge, Bose was quite a charismatic left-wing leader. In 1938, he was unanimously elected as one of the youngest presidents of the Congress. The 7th March 1938 issue of Time magazine portrayed him on its cover. It reported, quote, "Among the slick, satisfied top handful of Congress politicians, most of them obviously enjoying the incense of power and prestige, Subhash Bose stands out," unquote. But there arose a conflict between Bose and Gandhi, who was still the supreme leader of the Congress. Bose's uncompromising opposition to British rule and socialist leanings clashed with Gandhi's non-militancy and the Congress's right wing. They hardened their opposition to granting Bose a second term as president. Bose was, however, re-elected. The unthinkable had happened. Gandhi's will had not prevailed on the Congress. The Mahatma smarted, quote, "Since I was instrumental in inducing Dr. Pattavi Sitaramaya, Bose's opponent, not to withdraw from the contest, the defeat is more mine than his," unquote. At his second anointing as Congress president, Bose was missing from the podium, struck by pneumonia. In his absence, a motion was passed binding him to form the new working committee, the party's highest decision-making body, in accordance with the wishes of Gandhi. This was obviously humiliating for Bose. Jawaharlal Nehru, a fellow left-winger in the Congress, later to become India's first Prime Minister, expressed the view that the Mahatma should accept Bose as president. He said, quote, "To try to push him out seems to me to be an exceedingly wrong step," unquote. Nonetheless, on the 29th of April 1939, Bose resigned as Congress president. On the 29th of November 1940, back at his second home, a British prison, Bose commenced an indefinite hunger strike at Calcutta's Presidency Jail. A week later, with his health deteriorating, he was allowed to return to his residence in the city. The governor of Bengal, John Herbert, stated, Bose was, quote, neither in custody nor on bail, unquote. Plain-clothed policemen kept watch on Bose's house. But on the night of the 16th of January, 1941, Bose, disguised as a Pathan, dramatically escaped from the premises. 10 days later, he had slipped into Afghanistan, which was beyond British jurisdiction. Traveling through Central Asia, he reached Moscow, from where, on the 2nd of April 1941, he took a flight to arrive in Berlin. No matter how imperative the need for India's freedom, the adage of an enemy of one's enemy being a friend was difficult to defend in the case of Adolf Hitler. Bose's sole meeting with the Führer was predictably a disaster. Besides, his proposal for a German endorsement of Indian independence was turned down by Hitler. Bose described the dictator as, quote, raving mad, unquote. Yet the stain of having sought Nazi Germany's support was hard to erase. In effect, Bose's 22 months in Germany were futile, other than a blissful reunion with his Austrian partner, Emilie Schenkel, and the birth of their daughter, Anita, now a retired professor of economics in Germany. On the 9th of February, 1943, he set sail on a submarine voyage to arrive in Southeast Asia on the 6th of May, 1943. On the 12th of June, 1943, Bose called on the Japanese Prime Minister Hideki Tojo in Tokyo and made an immediate impression on him. Tojo told the Diet, the Japanese parliament, quote, we firmly resolve that Japan will do everything possible to help Indian independence, unquote. The end of 1942 had seen the Axis powers successful almost everywhere. The German general Erwin Rommel was in Egypt. The rising sun was at its zenith from Japan to the Bay of Bengal. My second chapter is on the INA, its formation, fight, and failure, which led to the trials. After the fall of British-held Singapore to the Japanese on the 17th of February 1942, about 40,000 Indians in the British Indian Army, who were now Japanese prisoners of war, motivated by Japanese intelligence, formed the first INA. Within a year, though, this outfit became practically dormant. Bose's arrival in Singapore in May 1943, though, transformed the ambivalence into enthusiasm among the soldiers. His establishment of a provisional government of Free India in October in 1943 gave the INA a legitimacy it had lacked before. Hugh Toy, a British intelligence officer assigned to track down Bose in Southeast Asia, in his later biography of Bose, entitled The Springing Tiger, commented, quote, soldiers and civilians were ready for him, and they welcomed him boisterously, unquote. Bose's compact with the Japanese was also controversial. It signified aligning with an imperialist power, Japan, to combat another, Britain. The Japanese may have subdued British forces in the East, but had themselves been authoritarian and expansionist. Moreover, there was a difference in perspectives between the INA and the Japanese army. For the INA, It was a one-point agenda to liberate India, using Burma as a staging post. The Japanese objective, on the other hand, was to forestall a British offensive to retake Burma, which had fallen to the Japanese in December 1941. In fact, the directive issued on the 7th of January 1944 by the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters in Tokyo to the Japanese Southern Army in Southeast Asia was, quote, to capture areas near Imphal, which is in India, and in northeastern India for the defense of Burma, unquote. The INA, as a junior partner of the Japanese army, did see action and briefly controlled some parts of India, which was mainly in the area which is Manipur and Nagaland. But it was beaten back by British forces both in 1944 and 1945. Mohammad Zaman Kiani, a major in the British Indian Army, who became the INA's senior most field commander, maintained in his book, India's Freedom Struggle and the Great INA, quote, the Japanese attack on Imphal in 1944, without a doubt, came within an ace of success, unquote. But the winds of war had changed. The Japanese were on the defensive by the end of 1943. The durable success was hard to come by. Kiani explained, quote, the Japanese Bushido spirit and samurai tradition were still intact, but their home industry could not keep pace with the continuously increasing demands of the vast fighting fronts spread across the Pacific Ocean and the Indian and Chinese theaters of war. There was also the very important question of advanced technology. It can clearly be stated that the Allied, particularly American technology, was improving more rapidly than the Japanese. The Americans had also succeeded in breaking the Japanese secret naval code, unquote. Nevertheless, when Indians learned about the INA's endeavor after censorship of news was lifted in India in August 1945, they reacted hysterically to what they interpreted as dauntless heroism. Defeat was dismissed as immaterial. Daring to wage war against the mighty British was looked upon by Indians as estimable enough. Gandhi, hitherto a critic of boasts, not to mention of violence, proclaimed, quote, the hypnotism of the Indian National Army has cast a spell on us, unquote. The British Labour Party was elected to power in July 1945. In a cabinet meeting the following month, Prime Minister Clement Attlee explained why his government couldn't forgive Bose's INA. Nothing could be worse for the British, he said, quote, than to let the impression grow that rebellion was an easy thing that need not be taken too seriously, unquote. So the ball was set rolling to try those who had defected from the British Indian Army to the INA for treason in an exemplary fashion for Indians to witness at close quarters. The third and fourth chapters of the book deal with the trial blow by blow and the repercussions to it. The Viceroy of India, Lord Archibald Wavell, informed London on the 31st of October 1945, quote, there is great bitterness against the INA generally in the Indian Army, unquote. He was forwarding an assessment by General Sir Claude Auchinleck, Commander-in-Chief of Armed Forces in India, which said, quote, "I am strongly of the opinion that although men may be tried for other crimes, the general feeling throughout the army would be that they must be tried as traitors also," unquote. The Congress constituted a committee of 17 lawyers to defend the accused. They forewarned Wavell before the first landmark trial that the decision to hold it, quote, "will have far-reaching repercussions throughout the length and breadth of India. So deep and widespread is the appreciation of the motives and aims of the movement, of which the Indian National Army was an expression," unquote. Gandhi lent his voice to the entreaty. He asked Wavell, quote, "Can the government afford to ignore the almost, if not the wholly, unanimous opinion of Indians of all shades of opinion," unquote. A dormitory in the military barracks at Delhi's Red Fort was converted into a courtroom. 7 British Indian Army officers, 4 Britons, and 3 Indians comprised the bench of judges. The trial got underway on the 5th of November 1945, with 3 former British Indian Army officers who had switched allegiance to the INA, Captains Shahnawaz Khan and Prem Sehgal, and Lieutenant Gurbakhsh Dhillon, charged with waging war against the British King George VI. When asked how they pleaded, they emphatically answered, "Not guilty." The choice of accused by the British in what was going to be a showpiece trial was unwittingly a Himalayan blunder. Khan was a Muslim, Sehgal a Hindu, and Dhillon a Sikh, representing the 3 prominent Indian communities. India detonated with a united fury. On the 16th of November, 1945, a mere 11 days into the trial, Wavell, writing from his palatial premises in New Delhi to the British Secretary of State for India, Lord Frederick Pethick Lawrence, struck a drastically different note about the trial from the one only about a fortnight earlier. Quote, "I have just had a letter from the Commander-in-Chief, namely Auchinleck, expressing grave concern at the possible effect on the army of the INA trials," unquote. 4 days later, therefore on the 20th of November 1945, came an alarming secret note from the director of the Intelligence Bureau, Sir Norman Smith, to Wavell and the India office in London. It warned, quote, "The possibility of the development of the agitation in dangerous directions exists in a degree which demands constant watchfulness, and the threat to the security of the Indian Army is one which would be unwise to ignore," unquote. The agitation he was referring to was already the movement of people and their protests, which had started in India from October 1945 onwards. Smith also reported, quote, "The appearance of threatening posters," unquote, vowing 20 English deaths for every INA man hanged in Delhi and Calcutta. Sir Norman cautioned that this, quote, "does not make the position in respect of Europeans as satisfactory as could be wished," unquote. The next day, the 21st of November 1945, violent protests erupted in Calcutta and continued for several days. Dozens died as police opened fire on Hindu and Muslim demonstrators, who after decades of mutual animosity were suddenly on the same page. The governor of Bengal was forced to call in the army to support police. On the 24th of November 1945, in the midst of the Calcutta riots, Auchinleck communicated to Wavell, quote, "After careful consideration, I feel that reconsideration is the wisest. The evidence reaching us now increasingly goes to show that the general opinion in the army is in favor of leniency," unquote. A court-martial under the Indian Army Act could only administer one of two sentences, a death penalty or life imprisonment. Auchinleck, in his note, was already considering clemency. He argued, quote, "If the sentence is to be commuted, it can only be on the grounds that the men acted in good faith, and in that case it would be illogical to imprison them," unquote. This was a stunning climb down in a matter of mere 3.5 weeks. From branding the INA men as traitors to accepting they might have acted in good faith, Wavell agreed with Auchinleck's line of action, and so camouflage from the Indian and British public, Operation Backtrack was initiated. On the 1st of December 1945, Auchinleck received Nehru. It was an unusual gesture. A commander-in-chief of Imperial Armed Forces entertaining a relentless opponent of empire, especially when Nehru was in an overtly implacable mood. But it was statesmanship on the part of the general. The London Times, carrying an Associated Press report the following day, recorded, quote, "He," namely Nehru, "said that stories of exploits of the Indian National Army had led many younger Indians to question the Gandhi philosophy of nonviolence. Many of them were now thinking about the possibility of force as a means of gaining independence," unquote. The agitation against the trial intensified as the hearing progressed. Bhulabhai Desai, a Congress activist and Bombay lawyer, was entrusted with the task of defending Khan, Sehgal, and Dhillon. And his was a heroic performance, which held Indians transfixed for 2 months and stirred them to a boiling point. Desai argued, quote, "Here is a case in which I venture to say, and the evidence supports it, that it is not at all a case of what you might call three individuals waging war against the king. The evidence amply bears out the fact that these men charged before you were a part of an organized army, which waged war against the king, even according to the prosecution. What is therefore on trial before the court is the right to wage war with immunity on the part of a subject race for their liberation," unquote. Desai submitted that the matter came under international law, for it had been a war between the British government and the Provisional Government of Free India, which the INA represented. He cited the American Declaration of Independence and pleaded, quote, "There was before the American people a conflict between the allegiance to the King of England and the allegiance to their country, and they chose allegiance to their country in preference to allegiance to a foreign king, unquote. The military tribunal heard from the Advocate General of India, Sir Nauchirwan Engineer, who asserted, quote, "I submit that all charges against all the accused have been proved beyond any reasonable doubt. There is no defense in law to the charges against the accused," unquote. Then came strange doublespeak, quote, "There is a good deal of evidence to the effect that what the accused did was done by them not with any mercenary motive, but out of what the accused bona fide consider to be patriotic motives and impelled by a sense, whether wise or misguided, of doing service to India," unquote. The accused were found guilty of the charge of waging war against the King Emperor. On the matter of sentencing, the court's hands were patently tied. It pronounced life imprisonments for all three defendants. However, as the confirming officer, Auchinleck decided to remit the sentences.
Sorry to interrupt you. I think the books have arrived. Should we just leave them outside? I don't think anybody will walk off with them.
Yeah, okay. I hope I could. Desai had prevailed at the court of public opinion, swayed Indians, even a section of Britons, in the British Indian Army, and persuaded the Commander-in-Chief himself to change his mind. On the 12th of February 1946, in a note to General Officer Commanding-in-Chiefs under him, Auchinleck laid threadbare that, quote, "any attempt to enforce the sentence would have led to chaos in the country at large, and probably to mutiny and dissension in the army, culminating in its dissolution," unquote. On the 2nd of March 1946, the Indian Daily, The Statesman, quoted Nehru as saying that Khan, Sehgal, and Dhillon, unquote, a quote, were not released owing to demonstrations in India, but because the Indian army had demanded their release, unquote. In a foreword to the transcript of the trial, which I was lucky enough to access here at Oxford, Nehru wrote, quote, "No trial in India, either by court-martial or in the civil courts, has attracted so much public attention or has dealt with issues of such fundamental national importance. Those three officers and the Indian National Army became symbols of India fighting for her independence. A trial of strength between the will of the Indian people and the will of those who hold power in India," unquote. Intelligence inputs about the disconcerting public mood in India, followed by the Calcutta riots, which were uncontrollable for several days, and then Auchinleck's second thoughts about the trials resulted in Whitehall attempting to extend a hand of conciliation. On the 4th of December 1945, Pethick Lawrence made a statement in the House of Lords. The Times reported, quote, "The government regarded the setting up of a constitution-making body in India as a matter of greatest urgency," unquote. But added, quote, "The statement contained a warning against any attempt to resolve the constitutional issue by force, unquote. The Times' headline in a corresponding piece from Delhi was, quote, Congress Party coolness, unquote. The Congress also felt the lecture on law and order was uncalled for. Public outrage in India over the trial rumbled on. So on New Year's Day 1946, Pethick Lawrence reached out to Indians again, this time over the airwaves. The Times reported, quote, he, the Secretary of State for India, believed the whole British people earnestly desired to see India rise quickly to the full and free status of an equal partner in the British Commonwealth. There was no longer any need for denunciations or organized pressure to secure recognition of India's due position in the world, unquote. The new formulation of equal partner in the British Commonwealth meant persevering with King George VI as India's head of state. This was unacceptable to the Congress. Behind the scenes, though, work had begun in London to conceive concrete measures to meet Indian aspirations. Meanwhile, the situation worsened. On the 18th of February 1946, mutiny broke out in the ranks of the Royal Indian Navy. A commission of inquiry into the revolt concluded that contact with the INA, the trial of its men, and political meetings which whipped up pro-INA and patriotic sentiments were among the factors that rendered the mutiny a political complexion. The British Sunday Times, carrying a dispatch from Delhi on the 24th of February, described that, quote, strong racial feeling against the British, temporarily submerging the traditional Hindu-Muslim differences, undoubtedly underlines the recent outbursts of mob violence and naval indiscipline, unquote. In 1929, the Congress at its annual session in Lahore passed a motion demanding Purna Swaraj, or complete independence. British authorities paid no attention to the resolution until in 1942, after Japanese forces had swept through Southeast Asia and arrived at India's doorstep in Burma. Sir Stafford Cripps, a Labour minister in the War Cabinet of Prime Minister Winston Churchill, went out to India with an offer of conditional dominion status. This was rejected by the Congress. King George VI, in his address at the opening of Parliament in August 1945, said, quote, in accordance with the promises already made to my Indian peoples, my government will do their utmost to promote, in conjunction with the leaders of Indian opinion, the early realization of full self-government in India, unquote. Self-government meant dominion status. On the 5th of November 1945, the day the epoch-making first INA trial began, Britain was still only prepared to concede dominion status. In a matter of 18 weeks, though, this remarkably changed to complete independence. My final chapter portrays the speed with which matters moved in London in the aftermath of the trial to culminate in an acceptance of the principle of complete independence. On the 15th of March 1946, Prime Minister Attlee told the Commons, quote, "I hope that the Indian people may elect to remain within the British Commonwealth. If, on the other hand, she elects for independence, in our view, she has a right to do so," unquote. For the first time in Britain's rule of India since 1757, the word independence had been uttered at any consequential level of the British government, whether in Britain or in India. That too from the pedestal of the UK's Prime Minister. In the same statement, Attlee informed the House that the idea of nationalism in India had, quote, "spread right through, and not least perhaps among some of those soldiers who have done such wonderful service in the war," unquote, referring to the British Indian Armed Forces. He could not have been clearer that the INA phenomenon had disturbed the devotion of Indian soldiers in the British commanded services. I take this opportunity to thank St. Anthony's College for giving me the chance to work here. I'm grateful to Professor Devji, Warden and Professor Roger Goodman, and Librarian Amy Berlakova for their warmth and cooperation. As for today's event, I'm indebted to Professor Nandini Gupta and Claire Salter for so kindly organizing it. I hope those who read the book agree that the INA trial did indeed shake the serenity of the British administration and thereby hastened acceptance of the principle of complete independence for India. I respectfully commend the book to you. Thank you very much for listening.